Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we get to talk with Dr. Nicole Lurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, about the next epidemic, protecting your health.
You know,
remarkable
Christy,
woman.
Yeah, a remarkable woman and leader. But also, this is such an important topic as we think about the Ebola scare mm-hmm. that we've been through and remembering back to anthrax and SARS and all these scary things. And then we think to the future about globalization and emerging diseases and famine. What do we need to know? She'll be able to help us.
Yeah, but first we have some research that matters to talk about. Some studies related to physicians being competent in health disparities, in particular LGBT.
About sleep and pain and the relationship and what that may mean.
About the benefits of HPV vaccine for teenage girls.
And can one less sugary soda a day keep the doctor away?
Very nice. We'll talk about that in relationship with diabetes. But first, let's talk about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people and health disparities and whether or not physicians have some work to do to be competent to take care of people.
So the question that Christy is referencing is a simple one, straightforward, but to care for LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender populations, should the physician have some training in the culture and some of the concerns of that population? Would they do better? And I think that's a legitimate question, and it's actually one to actually ask ourselves. Where do we get the training that we've had to care for that population competently?
Well, and what we know is that LGBT individuals are more likely to be uninsured. They're less likely to seek health care. There's some elements of fear of stigma or perhaps being treated inappropriately by health care systems or by individuals. And so it is important that we are aware and sensitive to those factors that can affect our patients' health, whatever their choices may be or whatever their life and situation may be.
Yeah, and we saw that pediatrician up north, unnamed city, who wouldn't care for a lesbian, gay couple who had a child and brought that child because that physician was uncomfortable. And it creates all kinds of questions here.
It does.
And so beginning to untangle this, and this was a research study in the American Journal of Public Health, where they surveyed academic faculty practices across the United States, and they only had a 50% response rate. Basically, what they found is that a large majority of the people responding on behalf of these academic health centers indicated there wasn't a lot of formal training being offered in providing culturally competent care to these populations. So it raises the question, could we do better? What do you think, Christy?
Sure, we could do better. I mean, we know by looking at the data that there are health disparities for different segments of the population. And so, yes, we have to do better. We have to do better to care for people and meet them where they are and care for them irrespective of those elements that make their lives different than our own or maybe their view or their religion or whatever it is, that we have to be able to be aware of those biases that we have and meet people where they are.
Well, I know you direct a residency training program. And I guess maybe one of the first things that we could do is we may not be able to change the entire world.
That's right.
But maybe we can start within and have a conversation with our trainees and our medical students and our curriculum about maybe some things that we could do better. It's a good warning. It's a good educational message for us all.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is about a link between insomnia or impaired sleep and pain tolerance.
Yeah, this was actually a Norwegian study that was published in the journal called Pain, seems like an appropriate journal, and they looked at over 10,000 adults in Norway, and they actually gave them a standard test of pain sensitivity called the cold presser test. They were asked to keep their hands submerged in a cold water bath, throughout a 106-second test, almost a two-minute test to keep your hand in very cold water. Interesting study.
And they had separately asked questions of the subjects about their sleep and their sleep time and how long it took them to fall asleep and that sort of thing. What they found was that the participants who had insomnia were more likely to take their hand out early, so they couldn't tolerate the pain as long or as much, and that pain sensitivity increased with both the frequency and severity of insomnia. So the worse sleep you got, the faster you took your hand out because you couldn't tolerate the cold water or the cold test. So, you know, really suggesting this link between not sleeping well and pain.
Yeah, I think that there's a link here. I think there's some pathways. I think this is kind of interesting. I'm not sure the direct analogy about putting our hands in ice water for 2 minutes and taking it out early. Perhaps these people who took it out early were smarter.
Yeah, that's right. There
was something we said that, you know, like, okay, this is painful. I'm aware of it. Let me get it out sooner.
Yeah.
But we should all be aware of the linkages between things like good sleep and being in pain. If you're in pain, you're not going to sleep well. That seems pretty obvious to me.
It's true. And maybe if you're not sleeping well, it might make your pain more unbearable. So talking with your doctor about that linkage and making sure you're paying attention to both elements of your life would be important.
And keeping your hand out of ice cold water for 106 seconds, if possible.
That's right. Well, now we're going to talk about one of the only vaccines we have against cancer, the HPV vaccine.
Yeah. And this was some really, I think, groundbreaking research that came out of our colleagues to the north up in Canada, where they tracked 260,000 kind of young adolescent teenage girls, half of whom were eligible for a school-based program that offered this HPV vaccine free of charge to eighth grade girls. And the other were in grade eight prior to the program, which started in 2007.
And they found that the girls who received the vaccine over time had a large and significant reduction in cases of cervical dysplasia, which is a precancer lesion that can happen in the cervix related to or due to the HPV virus that then goes on to become cervical cancer in some cases.
Yeah, for every 175 girls who received the vaccination, one fewer case of cervical dysplasia occurred. This is amazing, really, because these are really young teenage girls, and this was found really quite quickly. So it suggests to me that the benefit is fairly large and fairly immediate. And compared to many of the things we do, we should be doing this more often. We should be offering this more often and educating parents. It's not about whether or not your child is going to be sexually active.
It's about
that we
preventing
cervical cancer.
That's absolutely right. We can prevent cancer. Talk to your doctor about that. Now,
If
you drop one sugary soda a day, can you cut your risk of getting diabetes?
Well,
maybe.
I think there's more to this than meets the Diet Coke threshold. But this was actually published in the journal Diabetologia, not an easy journal to pronounce. And it was looking at this relationship between 25,000 middle-aged and older British adults who were diabetes-free when they entered the study. And then over the next decade, close to 1,000 were diagnosed with the disease and seeing how many of them had sugary soda or sweetened milk and the risk of diabetes.
And they found overall that the more sugary soda or sweetened milk that people consume, the higher the risk of developing diabetes. And even for every extra daily serving, the risk of diabetes rose by about 22%. They tried to control for things like body weight, exercise habits, education levels, other things that could be a part of it. But it's further evidence, really, to suggest this link in sugary sweetened beverages and sodas and diabetes.
Yeah, and they estimate, again, that eliminating this, which is really a function of calories as well as the type of sugar that you know comes there, you know, replacing it with, in this case, water, a spoonful of water keeps the
spoonful of water
diabetes away. It, you know, seems again, this is a good thing. Some very simple things that science supports. So that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a good chance to really talk about not only that perhaps less sugar in the diet, less sugar sodas could really help improve your chances of not getting diabetes.
About HPV vaccine for girls and boys before they're sexually active and for girls that can prevent cervical cancer.
About being more aware of relationships between pain and sleep disturbance.
And about the importance of physicians being competent and culturally sensitive and aware for various people, including LGBT.
We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Nicole Lurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, about the next epidemic, protecting your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Nicole Lurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, about the next epidemic, protecting your health.
Welcome, Dr. Lurie.
Thank you.
Now, tell us what sparked your interest in becoming a physician, a general internist, and then to go in this direction of preparing, responding to emergencies and medical crisis.
Great question. Well, my interest was sparked to become a physician really early on in life, probably as a high school student. I had the opportunity to work with a pediatrician who was an infectious disease doctor, but who noticed that lead poisoning was the prominent issue in her community. And I worked for her sort of as a research assistant and got very interested in the relationship between urban poverty and health. And when I went to college, I decided that one of the best ways to address that was to become a doctor.
So my work as a... already lens towards public health.
What?
You already had a lens towards public health before you even went to medical school.
I did, and that's always stayed with me. And my interest in preparedness and response really grew after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks, when it became really clear that for public health systems, we didn't have a good definition or a roadmap for what it meant to become prepared. So I started working on that in my research life.
So what were you doing when then 9/11 came about, and how did that event then? It sounds like that was a pivotal event to kind of change somewhat your professional career path.
It was. I was actually working half-time in the Minnesota Department of Health and doing primary care the other half. And when 9/11 occurred and when the anthrax attacks occurred, I was really asked to help on the state level, anticipating what might happen next and what the kinds of needs were in a state that wasn't directly affected by those events, but for which there was tremendous fear and a lot of emergency planning that was needed.
Well, I know we're going to talk about your national work, but in thinking about that particular role, thinking about the state preparedness, what kinds of things did you need to put into thinking of preparation for that at the state level?
Well, I think we needed to really think about what are the health department's role and responsibility, mm-hmm. What capabilities do state or local health departments need to have to be ready, what kind of funding is needed, and what kind of sustainable funding is needed. Ultimately, how do we measure and monitor our progress and continue to plan and improve? Because as you know, preparedness is a continuous process of improving and training and exercising and learning about the new and emerging threats that come our way. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about and worrying about bioterrorism in this job as well. It has been a significant focus. But we've seen time and time again that Mother Nature is a pretty sufficient bioterrorist to wreak an awful lot of havoc.
So, you know, I'm thinking back to the anthrax scare and then SARS, which we could talk about. And I'm thinking about through those kind of large national almost epidemics of fear that they created. What did we learn from each of those? Because it seems like if we're getting better, we're learning. What did we learn from the major national areas that people really said, oh my goodness, we might be at risk?
Well, great question. I think the first thing is that all of this is a reminder that a threat to the public's health anywhere threatens the public's health everywhere. And we've certainly seen that, and it's crystal clear. In Ebola, a health crisis is a very critical facet of global and national security. And so now we talk a lot about national health security. As you said, It's really easy to panic in the face of a new or scary disease, but it's best to take actions that are informed by science instead of by fear. And addressing and tamping down these epidemics of fear is really critical.
So what happened with anthrax? What did we do differently maybe afterwards, a year later, than what we were doing a year before?
Oh, we did a lot. And I think it's been a continuous process since then. We needed to define the basic surveillance and epidemiology and laboratory capacities of health departments. Hospitals and healthcare providers needed to learn how to recognize that and how to treat it. We needed to develop countermeasures, decide what antibiotics work, develop vaccines, develop other treatments for anthrax in that case. And we really needed to put plans and policies in place so that if our healthcare system saw a suspected case, that it could easily recognize that, alert the public health system, and that you could begin immediate surveillance to detect another release if there was one. So that really started to form the foundation for what is our preparedness and response many, many years later. And many of the systems that were put in place way back then and developed and strengthened since then are the systems that we used in place in this country to respond so effectively to Ebola.
So I am struck by your comment about needing, you know, science-driven lessons and this need to react quickly when things come and have a good plan for reaction, but also to be prepared for the unknown. And as health departments and governments sometimes work slower than we want it to, how do you balance being prepared for the unknown and balance resources for what we don't know what's going to be that next challenge? And so how do you approach being ready based on what's happened in the past? It's a lot of questions in there.
I think it's a terrific question, but I think it very much relates to the day-to-day life of a practicing primary care doctor. An awful lot of what you see in your practice is the same, day in and day out, maybe 80% of it, mm-hmm. maybe 90% of mm-hmm. it. And you have to be able to deal with that stuff really well and really efficiently. You also have to be open to that other 10%, the unusual presentation, the unusual clinical course, something that you've never seen before, but you've got to have the capabilities to recognize it and to deal with it quickly. We think the same about health departments. Hmm. The basic capabilities to respond to any kind of emergency or disaster are the same, and you need to be able to do those exceedingly well. But you also need to be able to pivot on a dime if something is unusual, if it needs a different kind of response. And if you can do the basic capabilities very well, just as you can do basic primary care really well, you've got the time and the agility and the mental space to be able to pivot and be creative and address the situation at hand.
It's a beautiful analogy.
We're talking with Dr. Nicole Lurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response in Department of Health and Human Services. And Dr. Lurie, tell us what was perhaps the most gratifying and perhaps the most surprising experience dealing with the Ebola crisis and scare here in the United States and maybe abroad.
The most gratifying, and what was the other part of the
perhaps
question?
The most surprising.
Well, probably the thing that was the most surprising and one of the things that has been very gratifying is to learn that in a setting where there's a well-resourced health system and good clinical care available, that Ebola probably is not as deadly as we thought it was. Mm-hmm. If you look at the cases that have been medically evacuated to the U.S. and to Europe, well over 80% have survived with good, solid medical care. And even now in West Africa, good hydration, IV fluids, checking electrolytes, the basics appear to be saving an awful lot more lives. So there was an awful lot that we thought we knew and took for granted about this disease that turned out not to be so accurate because it's a disease that has only been seen in extremely under-resourced settings.
Well, interesting. Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, I think we'd like to maybe continue the conversation about kind of the epidemics of the present and maybe the future, maybe even talking about global warming, and is that an epidemic, and what do we do for public health perspective? Lots of things, but we're going to take a short break. We'll continue talking with Dr. Nicole Lurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, about the next epidemic, protecting your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Nicole Lurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, about the next epidemic, protecting your health. And before the break, Dr. Lurie, you were sharing with us the importance of learning through science and being able to coordinate health systems within states and across the nation to be ready and to act in a systemized fashion. And thinking about Ebola and the crisis, some things worked really well, and it was very, very scary for people. Adam alluded to the fear and the panic that comes with these things, but how do you balance the message of calming the people and making sure you're being truthful and managing the fear?
Well, and this is especially challenging in this new age of social media, where people get their information in very fragmented and segmented ways. And, you know, information travels the globe in the speed of electrons. And so checking the rumor mill and putting out rumors is really important. But clear communication and good communication with the public is absolutely key to keeping people calm and addressing panic. It's really important to communicate what you know and what you don't know and be straight up about both. And it's important to help people understand that there are actions that they can take that will protect themselves. And in the case of Ebola, you know, those actions had to do with not coming in contact with body fluids of people who were affected with Ebola. And for healthcare workers, upset of very strong messages about the appropriate use and putting on and taking off of personal protective equipment.
You know, when I think about where we were at, perhaps at the outset of the HIV epidemic and the fear that was there, to today's society that maybe still has fear but has a really different way of understanding what that means, we've learned a lot, and the science seems to have driven that. You alluded to the fact of getting the message out there when we don't know things. How do you communicate uncertainty? And what is the actions one does in the face of uncertainty?
Well, first of all, we always try to make decisions with the best available science. And our actions have to be informed by the best available science instead of by fear. One of the things that we saw during the Ebola episode in the United States is an awful lot of people took actions based on fear instead of science. And so we have to balance all of our communication and our interventions to be sure that we use the best available science. And so in this case, we pivoted and adjusted the guidance on personal protective equipment, but we were able to reiterate what we knew about the transmission of Ebola, you know, that you don't get it from breathing the air, you know, that you only get it from coming in contact with the body fluids of an Ebola-affected person, or for healthcare providers, from incomplete practices when it comes to using personal protective equipment. And we're lucky in the United States because we have all the equipment available to us and is there to use and to use properly. You know, in the case of actions that related to school systems, employers, others being fearful of people who were of West African descent or had recently traveled here from West Africa, it was really important to communicate again and again and again the science to be sure populations weren't stigmatized, et cetera. Over time, it's also been critical to help people understand, as we said, that this is a survivable disease, mm-hmm. and to tell the public the kinds of things that we're doing scientifically to advance our understanding.
Yeah, you did
and
a
in this case,
job,
we now have two vaccines and a very promising therapeutic that are in clinical trials in West Africa.
Well, and thinking of in that moment in the crisis, I'm sure that people are happy to give money and to rally around the fact that you need funding to protect our nation, to protect the people in the world across the globe. But as we look ahead to the unknown in engendering funding for natural disasters or future bioterrorism or things that are unknown, how do we approach that as a nation to make sure that we're putting enough funding in to being ready when there's not an immediate crisis?
I'm so happy that you asked that because, you know, in this country, our public's memory is very short. Mm. And once we're past the immediate crisis, we tend to forget that we need to sustain a system of preparedness. And so we've seen funding for preparedness continue to decline over the past couple of years. And it's only after a big emergency, Superstorm Sandy, Ebola, that you get this bolus of money into the system. But nobody can plan and prepare with, you know, money that comes in sporadic ways every couple of years. We need reliable, sustainable resources to really do the job that's necessary. We know that with climate change and with other with the globalization of our world, that we are going to have more natural disasters and more infectious disease crises as diseases can circle the globe very, very quickly, and we're going to see the emergence of new and reemergence of old infectious diseases. And the system has to be strong.
So a great example
of a strong system we saw last week with the Amtrak crash in Philadelphia. So over 200 people were injured. Sadly, I think it was 8 people that died. But what you saw was a prepared system able to identify people who were injured and get them apportioned to all of the different trauma centers and hospitals in the area so that no one place got hit with an unreasonable number of patients, and the patients were distributed around so that everybody could take care of patients in a well-organized and a well-coordinated fashion. That only happens with planning and practice and practice and practice and stable funding.
So I'm going to make you a genie. I'm going to give you a 3 wishes. In terms of the funding, if the funding was unlimited, what would be the 3 wishes that would help us really deal as a society from your leadership position for the next epidemic?
Maintaining and continuing to build a strong public health system, both here and in countries where there is not a strong health system infrastructure to do surveillance and laboratory testing. Being sure that our health care system is prepared and stays prepared, and that means not only hospitals, but nursing homes, dialysis facilities, the EMS system, all of the parts of the healthcare system that have to work. And then the third would be continuing to invest in the development of countermeasures, whether it's vaccines or therapeutics. So the science is getting so much better that we can make these things faster and faster now. And to have a system that can stand up and develop new vaccines or new therapies quickly and get them to people fast enough to make a difference in the outbreak.
A related question for you personally. You've had such an accomplished career, and we have no doubt that will continue, and we're grateful for your leadership. But what impact do you hope to have on public health and humanitarian efforts as you look forward?
That's a great question. So I think in the last 6 years that I've been in this job, we've put in place many, many improvements in our preparedness system. And I'm very proud of those accomplishments. And, you know, they range from the achievements of the National Disaster Medical System to making mental health an important part of all responses. And, you know, I could go on and on with accomplishments. Going forward, one of the things that I think is terribly important is to be sure that we are ready at a moment's notice to do the science and the research necessary never to be in the same place twice. Mm-hmm. In some sense, you never let a good crisis go to waste. But on the other hand, you have to collect the knowledge and do the research to be in a much better position the next time. In H1N1, I think we fell short. In deep water, I think we fell short. And in Ebola, I think we fell short. With each one, we're getting a little bit better. but we have a really long way to go there.
Well, I love the fact that you approach it from really learning from each one and coming at it from a position of strength and knowledge and responsibility to be better prepared for each next crisis.
We have to be.
Yeah, I think you've remarkably managed to make preparedness not only sexy, but sustainable. And that should not be underestimated. We will never underestimate you. And thank you for your leadership. And thank you for spending some time with your health listeners.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. So one last point to make is that preparedness really rests on the back of strong day-to-day systems. And investments in preparedness and response also make day-to-day systems stronger. So when you look at the issues of sustainability, the system for preparedness is not a standalone system off to the side, but it is very integrated into everything that we do day to day.
We are grateful for your leadership. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Dr. Nicole Lurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, about the next epidemic, protecting your health. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And we'd like to hear from you. Please send us any comments or questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Eric Norrie, to read us our very first House Call today about something called microhemorrhages.
Recently, my mother went to the doctor and was diagnosed with a microhemorrhage. They said it came from small vessel disease. She's not diabetic, nor has she had high blood pressure, and she's never smoked a day in her life. We're really confused. We are wondering, what can be done?
Well, that's an unusual but important question, because sometimes things are diagnosed that are confusing.
Right. So these are small hemorrhages or small damage that can happen to the smaller vessels in a person's brain or body. And you're right in that usually that is linked with having diabetes or having high blood pressure and sort of the damage that that causes to blood vessels over time, or related to smoking. So those are the three most common reasons why people have these types of problems.
And you didn't mention, but we would want to know what the cholesterol value mm-hmm. is, because sometimes lowering that cholesterol value may lower the risk of these elements. And even though she doesn't have high blood pressure, I'd be curious to know what the blood pressure is, because it may be that the blood pressure is too high for her, or maybe someone hasn't said, oh, it's really high, but it could be borderline and maybe lowering it. So there's some things that certainly could be done, though the heart healthy things that we would normally do, so physical activity and more of a whole grain-based diet, and all these things that we do to protect the heart, it turns out they're good for the brain.
And there are some things that just, you didn't mention her age, but with age alone, that can just happen related to genetic factors and age. Even if you've done all the right things, there's just still risk for everyone. So it sounds like she's done a good job taking care of herself over life, and this is really unfortunate, and hopefully it didn't leave her with much by way of symptoms.
Yeah, talking with your family doctor, maybe talking with a neurologist, a good general neurologist. These are some good starting places to really help understand it better. Thanks so much for your question. That'll help many of our listeners. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I'm 60 years old and married, and I want to ask a difficult question. My husband is not interested in having sex, and he's not responding to my suggestion of getting counseling. Neither one of us are seeing anyone else, and I don't think either one of us wants a divorce. I would really appreciate your thoughts.
You know, this is an important question. If you hear nothing else, hear that this is important. Your marriage is important. The communication is important. Shared goals and thinking about how to work through this is really important in your partnership and moving ahead. So it's important that you're asking the question. The other thing to know is that it's really common. I mean, my patients, have a lot of patients who have the situation where one person either doesn't want to have sex and the other one does, or when they both just sort of stop for some reason, they don't really know why. And I would argue and try to encourage people that intimacy, in whatever way you guys can work it out, is really an important thing to move towards. And I would encourage you both to be talking with each other as the first step, but also seeking help to talk about what your shared goals might be.
Yeah. And I think this idea that there could be things we don't know about in here. So has your husband had prostate surgery or taking medications that maybe are causing impotence that make it undesirable for him to participate in sexual activity? And what does it mean to be intimate even outside of sexual activity and intimacy? At the very least, talk with your family doctor, your primary care doctor, and get some support and advice. Maybe see a sex therapist or counselor yourself, because there's, I think both you could benefit, but at the very least, you can get some support.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing your question. And we did a show one time about sex and your health, and should consider either replaying or revisiting that topic, because it is important as a part of your health. Let's take our very next house call question.
I've seen my family doctor for over 2 decades, and I have well-controlled blood pressure. I exercise regularly and am retired, so my stress level has really decreased in recent years. I went to my doctor a few days ago, and my blood pressure was the highest it's been in 10 years. This doesn't make sense. Even my doctor was confused. What does this mean?
Oh, it's got to be faulty equipment.
It could be. I would encourage you to get it rechecked before.
I go back to the doctor two days later and check it again is one of the first things I would do.
Yeah. And I mean, hopefully your doctor asked you questions about substances, tobacco, drugs, other medication changes that could be happening, stress, other things that could have been related to your blood pressure being higher. And I agree, you want to repeat it at a later time and be sure that you're reacting to something if it is so different than it usually is.
Though sometimes things just happen. Yep. And in this particular case, that could be one of the explanations, however unsatisfying that explanation may be, but we can get it down.
Yep. And so definitely follow up on that and make sure that you are taking medication changes or whatever it is that you need to get that blood pressure at a better spot to protect you.
And if you've been seeing that same family doctor for 2 decades, bring that family doctor a gift next time you see them.
That's
pretty darn amazing, and we love it.
Let's
have our very last house call, Erica.
My aunt has what doctors call lymphedema. She's been in great pain and gets infections in her legs very easily. She's really overweight and has been all of her life. Other than weight loss, what else really works?
Well, it's really unfortunate for your aunt. We appreciate you writing the question and caring for her. And it sounds like something that she's been suffering from. First, I'll say we should describe what lymphedema is, and we'll do our best to do it. But we'll also ask our fantastic health sciences librarians to post something with a picture about what is lymphedema and the lymph system, because it's a little bit different than what, when you just think about your regular blood vessels.
Right. We have the arteries that take blood away from the heart. We have the veins that bring it back to the heart. And you have these lymph vessels that help mobilize all the things that nourish our body and help fight off infections and kind of push things around to where they need to go. But with really a massive swelling and an extension of the skin, those lymph vessels may not operate really well. And so things just kind of sit out there in the tissue and it gets really swollen. And it can happen also if you've had to have lymph nodes removed because of surgery for cancer. What else works besides weight loss? Well, more weight loss. It's really important, and we need to focus and really keep working with that. There's also lymphedema clinics. Some places and academic health centers, University of North Carolina has one, specialized nurses that can help work and maybe come up with occupational therapists that can do very specialized things to help mobilize the fluid.
And there are also different strategies for compression that can sometimes be helpful to sort of keep, once you get the fluid in the right direction, to try to keep the right kind of pressure on that area. But it really is the best thing is in weight loss.
Thank you so much for all of your questions today. And thank you all for joining us today for your help. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health. Please share your questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. Follow us at yourhealthradio.org, Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or get our health app.
And we want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Nicole Lurie. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.